thank you for listening. We go out with Robbie Robertson, Wandering Souls.
Israel controls Middle East policy in the United States. Trump is in the pocket of Netanyahu, it seems. Without U.S. military support, Israel would not have been able to maintain their slaughter of Gaza for more than a few months. The United States enables Israel to ignore international law and to reject every single peace agreement. This is not an exaggeration.
That's Richard Forer. And this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Richard Forer on Israel, the U.S., and Palestine. Noam Chomsky calls...
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
I will be ordering the cessation of sanctions against Syria in order to give them a chance at greatness.
In a major policy shift, President Trump orders the end of U.S. sanctions on Syria and meets with Syria's new president. The meeting in Saudi Arabia came a day after the U.S. and Saudi Arabia signed a new $142 billion arms deal. As Trump lands in Qatar on his next stop, we'll look at Trump's trip to Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and the United Arab Emirates.
President Trump's trip to the Middle East is really about one thing, money. Whether it's about securing weapons deals and trade deals for the United States, whether it's securing a $400 million plane for his personal use, whether it's about making clear that the Gulf states can depend on the United States so long as they're buying from the United States.
We'll speak to Sarah Lee Whitson of Dawn and Akbar Shahid Ahmed of HuffPost. Then, to a Salvadoran journalist who had to flee El Salvador, along with others from the news outlet El Faro, after Salvadoran President Nayib Bukele threatened to arrest them for exposing how Bukele made secret deals with Salvadoran gangs. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Israel is intensifying its assault on Gaza as President Trump visits the Gulf region. At least 70 Palestinians, including many children, were killed earlier today when Israel struck five residential buildings in Jabalia City and its refugee camp. On Tuesday, Israeli warplanes dropped nine bunker buster bombs on the European hospital complex, killing at least 28 Palestinians and wounding dozens of others. Israeli officials claim the target of the attack was Mohammed Sinwar, a top Hamas leader. Hamas has denied claims it operates out of hospitals. Meanwhile, mourners gathered Tuesday in Khan Yunis for the funeral of the prominent Palestinian journalist Hassan Asliya, who was killed in a targeted strike earlier in the day while he was being treated at Nasser Hospital for wounds from a previous Israeli airstrike. He was the 215th media worker killed by Israel. This is the Palestinian photojournalist Samir Al-Bouji.
This is a violation of the sanctity of journalism and of our rights. The vest and helmet we wear no longer protect us, unfortunately.
Doctors in Gaza are condemning Israel for targeting two medical facilities Tuesday. Dr. Ataf Al-Hut is the director of Nasser Hospital.
I came to the hospital not knowing whether to mourn the martyrs, treat the patients and injured, or the staff who no longer feel safe. How can I protect in my capacity as the director of this place? We are speaking to a blind world that sees an amputated child, sees the limbs of children, and does nothing. I speak of women who were killed and exterminated. We speak of elderly people. What more is required of us now?
At the United Nations, the UN Emergency Relief Coordinator Tom Fletcher called on world leaders to, quote, prevent genocide, unquote, in Gaza. He slammed Israel's 10-week blockade, which has resulted in more than 500,000 Palestinians facing starvation in Gaza.
We have life-saving supplies ready now at the borders. We can save hundreds of thousands of survivors. We have rigorous mechanisms to ensure our aid gets to civilians and not to Hamas. But Israel denies us access, placing the objective of depopulating Gaza before the lives of civilians.
Fletcher also denounced a U.S.-backed Israeli plan to have private security contractors run aid operations in Gaza. Meanwhile, in London, the British High Court began hearing a case Tuesday accusing the British government of violating international humanitarian law by exporting F-35 fighter jet components to Israel. The case was brought by the legal groups Al-Haq and Global Legal Action Network. President Trump has arrived in Qatar after 2 days in Saudi Arabia. Earlier today, Trump met with Syria's new president, Ahmed al-Sharaa, the former al-Qaeda leader who helped topple the regime of Bashar al-Assad last December. During the meeting in Saudi Arabia, Trump urged al-Sharaa to normalize ties with Israel and join the Abraham Accords. Trump also asked the Syrian leader to deport Palestinians he described as, quote, terrorists. After the meeting, Trump said, quote, we're currently exploring normalizing relations with Syria's new government, unquote. The meeting took place hours after Trump pledged to lift U.S. sanctions on Syria in a major policy shift.
I will be ordering the cessation of sanctions against Syria in order to give them a chance at greatness.
Much of Trump's trip to Saudi Arabia focused on securing new investments for U.S. companies. On Tuesday, the U.S. and Saudi Arabia signed a new $142 billion arms deal in what the White House called, quote, the largest defense cooperation agreement in U.S. history. After visiting Qatar, Trump will head to the United Arab Emirates. We'll have more on this story after headlines. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky says he'll travel to Turkey this week to seek a ceasefire deal with Russia. The Kremlin, meanwhile, says a Russian delegation will be in Istanbul for possible direct peace talks, so it's not clear whether President Vladimir Putin will personally attend, nor is it clear whether President Donald Trump will join the negotiations. Ahead of his trip to Turkey, Zelensky said he'll only believe Russia is serious about ending its invasion of Ukraine if Putin joins the face-to-face talks.
If Putin will not come, or if ceasefire will not be supported by Russians, by Putin exactly, by him. So it's been only one thing, that Russia is not ready for any kind of negotiation.
Meanwhile, Russia's continuing its deadly attacks on Ukraine. Kyiv says Russia used 100 drones in an overnight assault Monday, while on Tuesday, Russian bombs killed three civilians in Ukraine's Kharkiv region. On Capitol Hill, police arrested more than two dozen people Tuesday as they protested Republican plans to gut Medicaid and other programs for the poor and working class to help cover the cost of $4.5 trillion in tax breaks for the rich. An emerging Republican budget proposal intends to cut social spending by $880 billion, largely by slashing Medicaid, which the Congressional Budget Office estimates would leave 8.6 million people without health care over the next decade. Protesters lined the halls outside a meeting of the House Energy and Commerce Committee Tuesday, while inside, a demonstrator was led away by police after disrupting the hearing.
You will kill me.
House Republicans are seeking to grant the Trump administration the sweeping authority to target nonprofits that don't align with President Trump's agenda. A measure included in the House Ways and Means Committee's draft reconciliation bill would grant the Treasury Secretary the power to declare any nonprofit as a terrorist-supporting organization in order to strip it of its tax-exempt status. In a statement, the nonprofit Fight for the Future called the measure a five-alarm fire for nonprofits nationwide, adding, quote, "This terribly thought-out legislation means that under the current administration, every environmental, racial justice, LGBTQ+, gender justice, immigration justice, and particularly any anti-genocide organization throughout the country may be on the chopping block," unquote. A federal judge in Pennsylvania has upheld President Trump's use of the Alien Enemies Act to deport Venezuelan immigrants without due process. U.S. District Judge Stephanie Lou Haynes' ruling is the first to support Trump's use of the 1798 wartime law, after judges in three other federal jurisdictions ruled Trump does not have the power to use the Alien Enemies Act to deport alleged gang members. Judge Haynes was nominated to the federal bench by Trump during his first term. On Monday, disgraced former Congressmember Matt Gaetz of Florida brought a television crew from the far-right One America News Network into the CECOT mega prison in El Salvador. Footage shows prisoners, some of whom were deported from the U.S. without due process, packed into crowded cells shouting freedom and using hand gestures calling for help. We'll have more on El Salvador, CECOT, and the Salvadoran president later in the broadcast. 20 U.S. states have sued the Trump administration after it threatened to withhold billions of dollars in federal funds unless states cooperate with Trump's mass deportation efforts. In a pair of lawsuits, the states argue Trump has exceeded his constitutional authority by dictating how federal funds should be spent when only Congress has that power. A federal jury in Wisconsin's indicted Milwaukee County Circuit Judge Hannah Dugan on charges of obstructing justice and concealing an individual from arrest. Federal prosecutors, including Attorney General Pam Bondi, have accused Judge Dugan of helping an undocumented immigrant leave her courtroom on April 18th to avoid arrest by agents waiting in the hallway. This month, more than 150 former state and federal judges signed an open letter condemning the arrest. They write, quote, "This attempt to intimidate the judiciary will fail. The American people understand that the Constitution of the United States has made the nation's judicial officers the guardians of the rule of law in our country, not the president," unquote. In New Jersey, Newark Mayor Ross Baraka returned to an immigration detention center Tuesday for the first time since his arrest by masked federal agents last Friday. Baraka is due in federal court on Thursday to face trespassing charges, where he's set to plead not guilty. He was arrested on Newark public property after he tried unsuccessfully to tour the 1,000-bed for-profit ICE jail with three Democratic Congress members, Bonnie Watson-Coleman, LaMonica McIver, and Rob Menendez. On Tuesday, Georgia Republican Congressmember Buddy Carter introduced a House resolution to strip the three Congress members of their committee assignments. This comes after the Department of Homeland Security threatened to arrest the lawmakers. On Tuesday, House Democratic leader Hakeem Jeffries dismissed the idea that Trump would seek to prosecute members of Congress.
No one's intimidated by this dude. No one. And so there are clear lines that they just dare not cross.
To see our interview with Mayor Ross Baraka, go to democracynow.org. A federal judge has stripped New York City of control over its jails, citing years of violence and neglect at the notorious Rikers Island Correctional Facility. Federal Judge Laura Taylor Swain said in Tuesday's ruling she would appoint a remediation manager to address widespread abuses, including physical and sexual violence, severe psychological harm to prisoners, and medical neglect. At least 38 people have died at Rikers Island since Mayor Eric Adams took office in 2022. And Jose Mujica, the former president of Uruguay, has died at the age of 89. He was elected in 2010 and was often described as the world's poorest president for his adoption of a simple lifestyle and his critiques of capitalism. During the 70s and 80s, he was jailed and tortured for 14 years for his activity as a guerrilla fighting Uruguay's military dictatorship. This is Jose Mujica speaking in 2014.
Humanity has to consider some issues that are global, and the central powerful countries are those that have the greater responsibility.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. When we come back, in a major policy shift, President Trump orders the end of U.S. sanctions on Syria and meets with Syria's new president in Saudi Arabia. The meeting came a day after the U.S. and Saudi Arabia signed a new $142 billion arms deal. As Trump lands in Qatar, on his next stop, we'll look at Trump's trip to Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and the United Arab Emirates. Stay with us.
It's 11:59 and 59 seconds. If I'm gonna die tonight, I want heaven. Hey, with you. It's 11:59 and 59 seconds. If I'm gonna die tonight, I want heaven. Hey, with you. It was 11:59 and 59 clicks. The whole world's burning, but the clock just ticks over and over every single day. Some people steal while other people pray to God, to man, machines, or whatever. Some of us just lost faith altogether. No way, they say, we can't live this way. That's why so many people stand up and say, one love, one blood, one heart, one soul, and one drum, and only one rhythm, one tribe, and all of us singing. It's 11:59 and 59 seconds. If I'm gonna die tonight, I want heaven. Hey, with you. It's 11:59 and 59 seconds. If I'm gonna die tonight.
11:59 by Michael Franti, here in our Democracy Now! Studio over a decade ago. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now!'s Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
President Trump has arrived in Qatar after 2 days in Saudi Arabia. Earlier today, President Trump met in Riyadh with Syria's new president, Ahmed al-Sharaa, the former al-Qaeda leader who helped topple the regime of Bashar al-Assad last December. During the meeting, Trump urged al-Sharaa to normalize ties with Israel and join the Abraham Accords. Trump also asked the Syrian leader to deport Palestinians he described as, quote, terrorists. After the meeting, Trump said, quote, we're currently exploring normalizing relations with Syria's new government, unquote. The meeting took place hours after Trump pledged to lift U.S. sanctions on Syria in a major policy shift.
In Syria, which has seen so much misery and death, there is a new government that will hopefully succeed in stabilizing the country and keeping peace. That's why my administration has already taken the first steps toward restoring normal relations between the United States and Syria for the first time in more than a decade. I will be ordering the cessation of sanctions against Syria in order to give them a chance at greatness.
Much of President Trump's trip to the Gulf has focused on securing new deals for U.S. companies. On Tuesday, the U.S. and Saudi Arabia signed a new $142 billion arms deal and what the White House has called the largest defense cooperation agreement Washington has ever achieved. Trump claims Saudi Arabia has pledged to invest $1 trillion in the United States.
And with this trip, we're adding over $1 trillion more in terms of investment and investment into our country and buying our products. And, you know, nobody makes military equipment like us. We have the best military equipment, the best missiles, the best rockets, the best everything. Best submarines, by the way.
President Trump is now in Qatar, and then we'll head to the United Arab Emirates. He's facing increasing bipartisan criticism over reports that Qatar's preparing to give him a $400 million luxury plane known as the Flying Palace. We're joined now by two guests. In Washington, D.C., Akbar Shahid Ahmed, the senior diplomatic correspondent for HuffPost, is with us. His latest piece has headlined A Moment of Truth in the Middle East for Donald Trump and Steve Witkoff. His former forthcoming book on the Biden administration in Gaza is titled Crossing the Red Line. And here in New York, Sarah Lee Whitson is with us, the executive director of Dawn, an organization working to reform U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East. We welcome you both back to Democracy Now! Sarah Lee Whitson, let's begin with you. Your assessment of what's happened over the last 2 days, both his visits with these three countries, he's about to go to the United Arab Emirates, just landed in Qatar, in Doha, but also what this means for Israel.
Well, this is a very volatile moment in the Middle East, and we've seen some pivots that we really haven't seen for decades in terms of independent U.S. decision-making in the Middle East. President Trump has ended sanctions on Syria. He's reached a truce in Yemen with the Houthis. He's declared that he's going to have diplomatic negotiations with Iran, all without the consent or veto of Israel, which previously existed. Meanwhile, he's dramatically expanding America's economic ties to the Gulf states, declaring that if you can pay, then you can play. The massive announcement of trade deals with Saudi Arabia, $600 billion, the largest weapons deal, $148 billion with Saudi Arabia, and really no talk at all of a normalization with Israel as any kind of a condition, including for the development of a civilian nuclear plant. What we still don't know is what Saudi's going to charge the United States in return, whether there's going to be a defense pact, which is, of course, what Saudi Arabia has long been looking for.
And, Sarah, what about all of the CEOs of major U.S. corporations that have also headed to the Middle East as well for during these days? What do you make of that?
Well, I mean, the days of Saudi isolation in the wake of the murder of Jamal Khashoggi, when some of these very same business leaders absented themselves from appearing in Saudi Arabia are long over. And now I think American companies are looking to cash in on the billions of dollars of the Saudi Public Investment Fund, the Emirati Public Investment Fund, the Qatari Public Investment Fund. This is a boondoggle for American businesses because the Gulf states understand that in order to continue to secure U.S. protection, they must expand their investments in U.S. businesses.
And in terms of the ceasefire in Yemen that that Trump has implemented, as well as other actions he's taken that seem to be marginalizing Israel and the Netanyahu administration. What do you make of that?
Well, I mean, the ceasefire with the Yemen and the Houthis is an excellent development. And I wish that every other American president had ended failed catastrophic wars after a mere 2 months, which is the deadline that President Trump imposed on this foolish incursion into Yemen, which has put us back exactly where we were before the incursion started. This was never a conflict that the United States was pursuing in U.S. interests, but clearly to support Israel and to protect Israel. I think it's a very important signal that President Trump is now making decisions that more closely align with U.S. interests than with Israel's interests. I think it's very notable that the Houthis launched an attack on Israel a mere day after this ceasefire was announced, making clear, underlining really, that the ceasefire does not include sustaining or suspending attacks on Israel.
Akbar Shahid Ahmed, you've written an extensive piece about the meaning of this trip. And again, at this point of this broadcast, President Trump's landed in Doha, but he just met with the Syrian president and said they're dropping all sanctions against Syria, which also includes, presumably, against he himself, against the Syrian president. If you can talk about the significance of this moment and what you thought was most significant in the meetings in Saudi Arabia with the crown prince and the investment, a massive meeting of hundreds of CEOs. You see Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman sitting right next to Elon Musk.
Right, Amy. But with the meeting with President Shara, which is the first meeting between an American president and a Syrian president in more than two decades, that's a real signal that Trump, as Sarah Lee said, is pursuing a policy that's a little different than what the Israelis certainly would like. This is the culmination of a months-long battle within Trump's own administration that I've been reporting on, where there are still many neoconservatives, kind of pro-Israel hardliners, the folks who've been in the Republican ecosystem for many, many years, who were not supportive of this kind of policy on Syria. So for President Trump to be in Saudi Arabia, publicly embracing the Syrian president, not just saying hello, which is what the White House told us he was going to yesterday, he actually had a more extensive conversation and has expressed a lot of hopes for U.S.-Syria engagement. I think that's quite striking, right? It's certainly showing you a U.S. approach that, as some regional sources have described to me, they see as more even-handed because they believe now, rather than under the Biden administration, certainly, but even administrations before that, there was a U.S. policy very much conceived not just in coordination with Israel, but often shaped by an assumption about how Israel would react, right? Which was kind of shaping how officials were having even internal conversations. I will hazard, though, I think what's really significant to remember is who's not being talked about. There was also some chatter that Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas might come to Saudi Arabia. That didn't happen, right? And so even while President Trump is in Saudi, is making these conversations about peace between the U.S. and Syria, Syria and Israel, Gaza is still being pummeled, and we were still seeing a blockade of more than 70 days there, where one in five Gazans is facing extreme starvation. There hasn't been food, there hasn't been fuel, there hasn't been medicine, and all of that is backed by the U.S. So President Trump is putting forward this image that, yes, I'm not necessarily aligning with Israel at all times. At the same time, he's making significant concessions and approvals to Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's plan to continue the war, continue pummeling Palestinians.
And Akbar, what do you make? There's been a lot of press attention to this donation of the royal family of Qatar of a $400 million luxury 747 plane to President Trump or to the United States. What's your take on this?
I think, Juan, it's going to be a really serious wrinkle in President Trump's attempt at diplomacy. A lot of what he's trying to do, whether it's weapon sales, whether it's a potential defense treaty with Saudi Arabia, does have to go through Congress. I think this is going to become a significant issue. Democrats are going to latch onto this, claiming corruption, and some Republicans are already uncomfortable with it. I think the concern about this is not just about an ethical appearance of taking a gift from the Qataris, which has its own concerns. It's also about policymaking and real strategic danger. When I've been talking to regional officials, Western officials, U.S. officials, they're saying, look, Trump's deal-making approach is part of why he kind of plays so well with these Arab states that are very transactional, don't want to hear moralistic rhetoric about human rights, or even long-term strategy. They want to just pay to play, as Sarah Lee put it. But does that lead to just short-term wins, right? Or does that lead to the personal and private mixing in ways where President Trump can walk away saying, I feel great, I got this plane, and maybe I've got some deals. What's the long-term strategic danger there? You know, and a lot of my reporting on Trump and his envoy to the region, Steve Witkoff, has focused on how they're pursuing really unconventional, really personalistic dealings with these leaders. In one instance, the leader of the United Arab Emirates, Steve Witkoff, who's Trump's envoy, had a 10-hour meeting with him where he didn't tell any other U.S. officials what was discussed. So that kind of policy-making process, I think, is the risk behind this extreme, personalized, and potentially corrupt relationship.
I mean, I want to... Akbar, I wanted you to talk more about who Steve Witkoff is. I mean, this trip started before President Trump got on the plane to Saudi Arabia, right? It started with Adan Alexander, the Israeli-American hostage who Israel didn't negotiate to get him out. The U.S. negotiated directly, presumably with Witkoff, with Hamas to get him out. And he didn't meet with Netanyahu, and he's coming to the United States. The significance of this complete sidelining, icing out of Israel that began before Saudi Arabia.
Absolutely, Amy. Witkoff has been the man shaping the region, not just since January when Trump took office, but to a large extent in November and December, in those waning months of the Biden administration. Witkoff was the person who really negotiated that Gaza ceasefire that did last from January to March. Since then is when you've seen the beginning of the sidelining you talk about. Based on my sources, I've understood that Witkoff has actually personally told people he felt played by Netanyahu because it was Israel that broke the ceasefire, went back into Gaza, and really undercut what Witkoff and, by extension, President Trump were trying to do. So this kind of sense of we don't have to coordinate with the Israelis is very much linked to Witkoff's view that he is a personally empowered envoy of Trump. He's a personal friend of Trump's. And importantly, he's personally wealthy and he's not political, right? So compared to, say, U.S. officials in previous administrations or even in this one, he's not someone who's looking at how do I advance international security establishment for years to come? How does challenging Israel potentially put me at risk? And so that's something where talking to a lot of regional officials, U.S. officials, they feel he is able to be a little more even-handed and a little less driven by a fixation on Israel. But I think that also puts him in the crosshairs of a lot of the pro-Israel kind of advocacy ecosystem that does exist, right? And we've seen that come out already. There's been a lot of attacks on Witkoff personally, his business ties with Qatar, his potentially, you know, unconventional tactics. But Witkoff very much has the trust of the president personally. And I discovered this kind of reporting on him, taking criticisms to the White House. They are ardently supporting him. And importantly, not just kind of lower-level officials, really high-ranking people like Donald Trump Jr., the president's son, and Vice President J.D. Vance are pushing Witkoff as an avatar, almost, of what they describe as a different kind of Trump foreign policy, saying we are promoting a foreign policy that will bring peace to the region. Really important to remember that foreign policy, of course, involves, as I said, continued pummeling of Gaza and huge weapons deals to regimes that have pursued huge wars. But it is one that isn't necessarily being driven by intense U.S. military entanglement, particularly with Israel. And I think that pattern will continue. You'll see that mostly play out in the next few weeks. I think there's a looming deadline and fight over Iran diplomacy, which Steve Witkoff, the president's envoy, is also leading. Again, very controversial for Israel, very controversial for national security hawks. I think there'll be a really intense kind of battle over what Witkoff is willing to do with Iran.
And Akbar, I wanted to follow that up on Iran. The willingness of President Trump to engage in negotiations over uranium enrichment with Iran. I'm sure that Netanyahu and the current Israeli government is not happy with this.
They're certainly not thrilled, Juan. Their preference would have been for a U.S. and Israeli-backed military strike by now, in fact, prior to now. Their argument is we as Israel, in this kind of post-October 7th moment in our retaliatory campaign across the region, have weakened Iran, right? They've weakened the pro-Iran militia in Lebanon, Hezbollah. They've, in fact, even weakened Iran's own air defenses. So the argument from Netanyahu and his government is, let us use this moment to take a strike against Iran, knock it out for good. The counter-argument to that is, of course, unintended consequences of a major war, and also that technical nuclear expertise doesn't go away. So the Trump administration is saying, let's try to reach a deal, and they have stuck by that despite facing criticism. What's kind of unclear still is how much expertise they'll develop. These are very hard deals to negotiate. It's worth remembering President Trump is in this situation because he abandoned a deal that the Obama administration had achieved, right, through extreme negotiation and technical expertise. The Trump team hasn't yet shown they kind of have that level of professionalism, and also they haven't really made clear how much they're willing to give up to Iran. Iran, given that it felt burned by the U.S., which did abandon the previous nuclear deal, which Iran was complying with, Iran has said, we want a little more. We want more guarantees to know this will be permanent. This will bring us the sanctions relief in exchange for nuclear limitations. And I think the Trump administration needs to kind of demonstrate that, especially in the weeks ahead. There is a looming deadline again because there are U.N. sanctions on Iran that will go back into place starting in July. So if there isn't some kind of temporary deal by then, all of this diplomacy by the Trump administration will get much, much harder and less likely to deliver.
So continuing on Iran, Sarah Lewitson, a few days ago, this whole idea being floated, this is a piece from the New York Times, can Trump rename the Persian Gulf? His suggestion to call the body of water the Arabian Gulf has apparently done the impossible, unite Iranians. But if you can talk further about what this means for U.S. Iran relations, but then also let's go back to Qatar and talk more about what exactly Qatar wants at this point. I wanted to bring in that clip. It's like 3 seconds of Trump defending taking that $400 million flying palace. This is what he said to a reporter.
It's not a gift to me. It's a gift to the Department of Defense.
It's not a gift to me. It's a gift to the Department of Defense. And of course, when he leaves, it's going to go to him or to go to the Trump Presidential Library, which means the U.S. will pour in hundreds of millions of dollars to refurbish it. But then it goes to Trump, and these new Boeing planes supposedly will be the new U.S. Air Force One. But what Qatar wants from this? And so first Iran, then Qatar.
Well, with Iran, obviously, President Trump made clear, even when he was a candidate, that his goal was to reach a deal with Iran. And he even talked about lifting sanctions on Iran, which, interestingly, Kamala Harris criticized and condemned. So I think Trump has made clear his willingness to engage in negotiations with Iran to lift sanctions, to reach a nuclear deal from the get-go. I think Israel assumed they would be able to curb that and instead get war on Iran. That's failed. Very interestingly, Iran has just proposed a joint nuclear development, uranium enrichment with the UAE and with Saudi Arabia, something that would have been unthinkable, but would certainly sweeten the consideration of what could be a civilian nuclear power for the entire region and brings these countries closer together. And I think that's a good thing. Anything that reduces the temperature of war in this region is a good thing. In terms of Qatar, Qatar depends on the United States for military protection. This $400 million plane is protection money, and it's directly protection money to Trump. But I don't think, even though the glaring flying machine that is an advertisement for Qatar is particularly glaring, I don't think we can take it out of the context of massive foreign influence, expanding foreign influence, the purchase of influence with money, with Gulf money. We have long had a U.S. foreign policy that has been controlled by money, including in particular pro-Israel money that has seeped into American politics, Democrats and Republicans. And now the Gulf states are in on the game more crudely and nakedly than ever before, as this plane signifies. And they're certainly outspending AIPAC, which is something that's making AIPAC and the pro-Israel supporters panic. But this, I think, represents the most glaring example of what has become the corruption of the U.S. political system, not just by domestic lobbying interests, but by foreign lobbying interests. So I think, in fact, all of this is quite depressing and disheartening because they are predicated on short-term gains, short-term financial gains, not just for President Trump, but for the entire establishment.
And Sarah, I wanted to ask you about Saudi Arabia. In a departure from his previous stance, Trump has suggested that Saudi Arabia will join the so-called Abraham Accords and forge relations with Israel, quote, in its own time. The significance of this?
Well, the significance of this is that Trump has successfully de-linked both the development of a civilian nuclear plant as well as this new trade deal. And I'm expecting a defense agreement, a defense cooperation agreement that will come from any normalization with Israel, whereas Biden had suggested that all of these things would be dependent on Saudi Arabia normalizing with Israel. That's off the table. But it's important to note that it's off the table because of Israel's own self-sabotage. It was really only Netanyahu Netanyahu and Israel, who are the primary reasons there is no normalization with Saudi Arabia right now. And the Trump administration has now clearly indicated that they are going to proceed on their business arrangements and military arrangements with Saudi Arabia, regardless of its normalization with Israel. This is one of the greatest acts of political self-sabotage that we've seen in the region for a while. It's pretty remarkable how close Israel was to normalizing with Saudi Arabia, but torpedoed that with its own fanatical, maniacal obsession with its genocide in Gaza.
President Trump, in talking to Bob Woodward, talked about how he saved the rhymes with glass of Mohammed bin Salman when it came to Khashoggi. You mentioned Khashoggi at the beginning, the founder of Dawn, your organization. But for people who may not remember what happened, if you can talk about that and the significance of Trump's very close relationship with the Crown Prince now, even as he said to Bob Woodward, I saved that, guys.
Well, that was a rare moment of clarity and honesty from President Trump, telling us, letting us know how he saved Mohammed bin Salman from global accountability, from judicial accountability, from complete ostracism with his crime that shook the world, which was the targeted kidnapping and assassination of a U.S. resident, Jamal Khashoggi, who had been writing critical columns about Mohammed bin Salman in Saudi Arabia. In the Washington Post, but also founding and launching an organization that was aimed at reshaping U.S. policy with Saudi Arabia and the region, promoting democracy and human rights in the region. After this murder, I mean, we know that the CIA was surveilling the WhatsApp communications between Mohammed bin Salman and his primary henchman, Saud al-Qahtani, both before, during, and after the murder of Khashoggi at the Istanbul consulate, the Saudi consulate in Istanbul, and he was caught red-handed. The Biden administration revealed and released the CIA's assessment that, in fact, Mohammed bin Salman ordered the murder of Khashoggi. But, of course, Biden capitulated on every front, going so far as to grant Mohammed bin Salman immunity from prosecution, though he is not the head of state of Saudi Arabia, because King Salman is still the head of state. So there was a complete pivot by the Biden administration, originally promising accountability for Saudi Arabia and then transforming into the fist bump and close ties with Saudi Arabia. So this is something that President Trump continues to have and hold over Mohammed bin Salman's head. They can release those messages showing Mohammed bin Salman's complicity in the murder of Khashoggi. I'm sure there are other secrets of Mohammed bin Salman's that the United States and the CIA have and will continue to lord over him. But right now, President Trump is focused on deal-making with Mohammed bin Salman.
Where is Khashoggi's body?
We don't know. One would think that at minimum...
killed in the Istanbul embassy.
Killed in the Istanbul embassy, reportedly either
of
burned.
Saudi Arabia.
The consulate of Saudi Arabia in Istanbul. Reportedly, his remains may have been disposed of in an incinerator at the premises or removed out of the premises and taken to a car wash to be disposed of. We don't really know. Saudi Arabia has never told us what they did with Jamal's remains. One would think they would have the dignity and respect to at least allow this man to have a proper burial, but that is not something we can hope for. And I want to remind people that Mohammed bin Salman may seem a little bit reasonable right now amidst the complete insanity of Israel in terms of the genocide in Gaza, but Mohammed bin Salman himself is a volatile, unpredictable, sociopath who continues to detain and imprison the mildest of critics in his country, who continued a 7-year senseless war in Yemen, resulting in over 300,000 deaths. And of course, not only did he murder Jamal Khashoggi in cold blood, but targeted and attempted to kill several other critics of his regime who live abroad, including in the United Kingdom, including in Canada, opening up really a field day of efforts of targeted assassinations.
And Sarah, I wanted to ask you,
The prospect of a Saudi-U.S. security agreement with, as you mentioned, the leader that Saudi Arabia has right now, the Crown Prince, the significance of it, why does Saudi Arabia even need it, given the close alliance it already has with the U.S.?
Right. So Saudi Arabia has been demanding a bilateral security agreement, treaty-level guarantees and protection from the United States for a while, basically to immunize themselves from the herky-jerky of a new administration that comes in threatening to reshape its ties to Saudi Arabia. And remember, President Biden said he was going to cut all military sales to Saudi Arabia in the wake of its atrocities in Yemen and the murder of Khashoggi. So they want to immunize themselves from the back and forth of U.S. politics by having this defense agreement. Interestingly, the White House's announcement of its meetings in Saudi Arabia, the $600 billion in promised investments, which let's see whether or not they materialize and how quickly they materialize, had no mention of a security agreement, no mention of U.S. security commitments to Saudi Arabia. I'm pretty certain that these things are going to come. I don't think Saudi Arabia is going to allow the United States to develop this civilian nuclear plant for free. China has been willing to do it, and they've been willing to offer the deal to China. Saudi Arabia wants something back, and it remains what the United States has to offer it, which is military and political protection.
We just have 30 seconds, but Akbar Shahid Ahmed, I want to end where we started today's show with our headlines, and that is in Gaza, the horror that is taking place there, the intensification of Israel's attacks right now on Gaza, the starvation, the killings, the airstrikes, and you're writing a book on what's happened in Gaza. Your final thoughts on where this could all lead? I mean, if President Trump, I mean, the number of negotiations he's engaged with coming to a ceasefire between India and Pakistan with the Houthis, recognizing Syria, if he stopped arms sales to Israel right now, there would have to be a ceasefire because Netanyahu could not proceed without those weapons.
I think, Amy, there's some hope of that, but fundamentally, I think it's so important to remember that President Trump has shown a really clear antipathy towards Palestinians fundamentally, right? These are not people who have something to offer him the same way that wealthy Gulf Arabs or others in the region do, or Iran, through a kind of preventing a war lens. So I think that while there's some hope and expectation of that, my conversations with people talking to the White House, hoping for something meaningful on Gaza, it's pretty low right now. I think there's a sense that there might be a fig leaf, something that says, here's a US plan to stop the fighting for a while. But that would really involve a really kind of pro-Israeli approach that humanitarian organizations are really worried about, would not necessarily help actual aid reach Gazans, and I think could very easily fall apart. So right now, there doesn't seem to be that interest and that deep expertise to deliver for Gaza, even though President Trump has this desire to be a Nobel Peace Prize laureate. But that may change, like everything in this administration, of course.
Akbar Shahid Ahmed, we want to thank you for being with us, HuffPost senior diplomatic correspondent speaking to us from D.C. And thank you to Sarah Lee Whitson, the executive director of Dawn. When we come back, we go to a Salvadoran journalist who's had to flee El Salvador along with his other colleagues from the news outlet El Faro after Salvadoran President Nayib Bukele threatened to arrest them for exposing how Bukele made secret deals with Salvadoran gangs. Stay with us.
Dijo Guevara de mi hermoso, viendo al África llorar, en el imperio mañoso, nunca se debe confiar, nunca se debe confiar. Y dijo el Che legendario, como sembrando una flor, al buen revolucionario solo lo mueve el amor, solo lo mueve el amor.
That's Silvio Rodriguez performing in Central Park here in New York in 2017. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We turn now to a journalist from El Salvador who's left the country, along with others, from the digital news outlet El Faro, after the Salvadoran president, Nayib Bukele, threatened to arrest them all. The outlet reported, quote, a reliable source in El Salvador told El Faro that the Bukele-controlled Attorney General's office is preparing at least 7 arrest warrants for members of El Faro following the publication of an interview with 2 former leaders of the 18th Street Revolucionarios on Bukele's years-long relationship to gangs. Bukele has run the country under a so-called state of exception since 2022, supposedly in order to weaken these same gangs. And Salvadoran authorities have detained nearly 80,000 people accused of being in gangs, largely without access to due process. Human rights groups report at least 250 people have died in El Salvador prison since Bukele's so-called war on gangs began. This comes as Bukele is working closely with the Trump administration to jail immigrants sent from the United States at SECOT, El Salvador's notorious so-called terrorism confinement center, the mega prison. In a moment, we'll be joined by El Faro's digital editor in exile. But first, this is a clip from one of El Faro interviews with a gang member. In it, we hear how just 1 month into the state of exception El Salvador back in 2022, despite having an arrest warrant being recognized as a clear leader of the 18th Street Revolucionarios, Charlie Cartagena was detained and then released after a mysterious phone call. This is Cartagena.
I'm telling you all this. That's a substation in Antiguo Cucatalan, so that's not a jail. You're really in there, and they had already taken my photo before. They were writing it up. I only heard when he told him, the manager there. Did you already post the news, he said? Not yet. I'm about to post it. Cancel it, he told him. Cancel it. Not right now. And they stood there. Why? And this and that. And he said, oh, well, those words are coming from up top.
From up top?
There's nothing we can do. And suddenly the call came in, man. I mean, the call came in and they just stared at me and said, take the handcuffs off him.
Under President Bukele, the fall of El Salvador's murder rate has been accompanied by a rise in forced disappearances. This point came up in El Faro's interview with a former Barrio 18 gang member who goes by Little Man, explaining how they carried out orders for handling murders allegedly under the direction of the chairman of Bukele's Social Fabric Reconstruction Unit.
Was that look, man? Gosh, talking to you about these points is very delicate, man, because it's like making myself worthy of something that maybe I do know, but I can't tell you because that's how it is. Do you understand me? I'm not going to tell you. There's never been a homicide, but I was said with Marroquín, if something is done without a body, there is no crime. That tells you everything. That tells you everything. Without a body, there is no crime.
No body, no crime. For more, we're joined now from an undisclosed location by Nelson Rauda Zabla, digital content editor for El Faro. Nelson, along with 6 other colleagues, faces potential arrest warrants for their reporting on Bukele's dealings with Salvadoran gangs. His new opinion piece for The New York Times is headlined, "The World is Finally Seeing How Dangerous Bukele Really Is." Nelson, welcome to Democracy Now! Explain why you and your colleagues have left El Salvador and the significance of this video that you released, what it says about the president of El Salvador.
Good morning, Amy. Thank you very much for having me. Well, you're talking about America's prime security consultant at the moment. The president Bukele is a man who says to be working for the security of Salvadoran people and has offered to solve the world security problems. Not long ago, he offered to lead a mission to Haiti, and he's selling the services because he supposedly has the solution for the world security problems. What we're doing is piercing the bubble. We're telling a story that's so different from that narrative, from the propaganda, because the man who says he has the solution for the gang's problem has actually made secret deals with him all throughout his rise through political offices, way before he was a president, but even now that he is a president. So, we're dealing with the consequences now. A Salvadoran prison is the last place that you want to be in. So I exited the country. I left El Salvador one day before the publication. And this is something that we have done routinely in El Faro, to exit the country, not only us, but other journalists in El Salvador, leaving the country to wake for the retaliation or the consequences or the reaction of the government from afar, from a distance. So we left the country, right now we don't know when we'll be able to come back. We don't know. We have our whole lives in El Salvador. We have families and our job is there in houses, but we're trying to make sure that we're safe first. And I think that's the significance, that we would not be facing this price if what we published was not as important as it is. It's telling the world that the president who says he's the has the panacea for security has actually been making secret deals with gangsters, with organizations that the U.S. considers terrorists. And when they tell it all, the videos have a great impact in Salvadoran society. They have over 1.5 million views in a country that's inhabited by 6 million people. This has really pierced through the bubble. We've seen analysis that says that more people saw the videos than people voted for the opposition in the last Salvadoran election. So that's the story we're telling, and we're grateful to be able to tell it, because American people should know that their government is doing dealings with someone who has been making deals with criminals.
And Nelson, it's not just your reporting on this, but back in 2021, the U.S. Treasury Department itself sanctioned two Bukele officials, accusing them both of negotiating with notorious local gangs in an attempt to seal a secret truce and shore up political support for Bukele. Can you talk about this, and who exactly is one of those officials, Carlos Marroquin, and his connection to the gangs and Bukele?
Carlos Marroquin is Bukele's designated man to deal with the gangs. He has done this job for Bukele before he was the president. He did it when he was running for San Salvador mayor, and he has stood throughout. But we found now that Carlos Marroquin, in at least two different cases, personally transported gang members indicted with arrest orders to the border with Guatemala. And we know this because Carlos Marroquin confessed that in an audio that we published, an audio that he sent to a gang member and that we published back in 2021. So I think Bukele's negotiation with the deals is not something, it's not a reported story. It's a fact. It's a fact that's been proven not only by journalistic investigation like the one that we've made ourselves, not only by the U.S. authorities like the State Department and the Treasury Department sanctioning not only Marroquin, but also Osiris Luna, who is the director of prisons, and also proven by a Salvadoran criminal investigation that is now thwarted, because Bukele's party removed the attorney general that was investigating him and his party and his officials put in place another one, the one that's made arrest warrants against us. So you're talking about a dictatorship, and you're talking about CNN reported last week that Bukele's brother, Ibrahim Bukele, said in an email that he wanted the return of seven MS-13 leaders, and that in exchange, he would be able to offer a 50% discount in the price that El Salvador charges to have Venezuelan prisoners and other prisoners deported to Secuat by El Salvador. Why is the Bukele government so invested, so interested in having these gang leaders removed when it's them that they let them go? That's the government has accused us, and a lot of the speakers for the government have accused us of collaborating with the gangs, when it's so blatantly obvious that we wouldn't have been able to arrest Charlie, to interview Charlie, if they wouldn't have released him. He was in jail. He was already arrested. He's supposed to be in jail. The only reason that we were able to interview him is that the government released him. And the fact having him on camera is a living proof that Bukele dealt with the gangs. And this goes so much against the narrative that he is, you know, this protector of Salvadoran people, because he has been making secret dealings behind their back. And we're just pulling that to light.
Well, we only have 30 seconds, but what has been the response by the people in El Salvador to the revelations of your news site?
El Salvador is in a great state of turmoil now. One of the reasons being this publication, but there's so many problems. I just want to say before I finish that I'm here speaking because there are many others that cannot speak, because Alejandro Enriquez, who was arrested last night in El Salvador, cannot speak right now, because Roberto Jaco, who died in a prison last night after being arrested last week by the government, can't speak right now, because the Pastor Angel Perez cannot speak right now. We're
Nelson
telling a story,
Radizavla,
and the words should say.
We have to go, but we're going to continue this conversation in Spanish at democracynow.org. Digital editor for El Faro.
And Amanda Smith from Nashville, Tennessee.
Keep it right here on WRCT Pittsburgh.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
Stay tuned for the One World Community Radio program on 89.5 FM Bush Radio, Cape Town, 88.7 FM WRHU, Hempstead Radio, Hofstra University, 88.1 FM WCWP, Brookville, LIU Post, 88.3 FM WRCT, Pittsburgh, Carnegie Mellon University, 88.3 FM WVCR, Loudonville, Siena College, 98.1 and 105.9 FM WKZE Salisbury Red Hook, and around the world at WRHU.org. This is One World Community Radio, coming up next on your favorite community radio station.
Radio program, a collaboration between 89.5 FM Bush Radio, Cape Town, South Africa, and 88.7 FM WRHU Radio, Hofstra University in Hempstead, New York. Broadcasting from the Bush Radio Salt River Studios in Cape Town is host me, Lydia Mahwanana. Broadcasting from WRHU Studios in Hempstead, New York, are your hosts, Cody Millar and Andy Gladding. We welcome you to join us for the next hour as we celebrate the power of community radio, music, language, and culture. The world is a big place, but using the power of radio, we're bringing it right to your door. Now, Bush Radio and WRHU welcome you to the one world of community radio.
Cause it's a
WRHU 88.7 FM Hempstead Radio Hofstra University, WRCT Pittsburgh 88.3 Radio Carnegie Tech, and 89.5 FM Bush Radio Cape Town South Africa, the mother of community radio. You are listening to the One World Community Radio Show. I'm Ricky Hubert in New York, joined by Lydia Marwanana in South Africa, and we are delighted to be joined today by Anne Liguori. Anne, thank you so much for coming on our show.
My pleasure. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you, too. Now, for those who don't know necessarily what you do or aren't familiar with your work, give everybody a synopsis, because you could probably do that much better than I could.
Well, I've been a sports broadcaster, journalist, and author for a long time now. I'm on WFAN. I was the first woman to host a call-in sports show. It was called Hey Liguori, What's the Story? It aired for 25 straight years every week. Now I have a show, a golf show on The Fan. The Fan is the number one sports radio station in the country. And we were the first all sports radio station in the country, if you can imagine that, before all these other radio stations went to an all sports format. And the show I do now is called Talking Golf. It's on Sunday mornings. And I was an original on the Golf Channel as well with my own TV show. And I have a show called Sports Interview with Anne Liguori, which aired for 17 years on sports cable networks throughout the country. And I own the archives to that, what I call a treasure chest of interviews with everybody from Mickey Mantle, Ted Williams, Hank Aaron, Will Chamberlain, Billie Jean King. I was in my 20s and 30s, about your age, maybe younger. I hosted, produced, sold the advertising for, distributed, researched, booked the guests, did pretty much everything for that show. And it, as I said, it aired for 17 years. That show now, I own the archives to it, and we license out the interviews.
That's all very exciting stuff. Now, something I wanted to get into in the beginning is because you mentioned this kind of laundry list of things that you did during your career, which we're going to get into, but it doesn't just happen one day. You wake up and you go, okay, I'm going to start my own show. I'm going to go on The Fan. How did you stumble upon this path when you were younger? Let's say college years, high school, whatever you want to call it.
Well, I've always wanted to be an interviewer, and I was always very athletic. So I kind of merged my athletic interests and abilities with my broadcasting career. And I always wanted to pursue sports broadcasting. You know, it doesn't happen overnight. It took years and years and years and years to build my career. And particularly when I started in the 80s, women weren't doing much in sports broadcasting. There weren't that many opportunities job-wise for women in sports. And when I first started on WFAN, it was very different. A lot of people weren't used to hearing women talking sports at all, particularly not a call-in sports show. So it took a long time to prove myself, establish my credibility. From there, I pretty much worked very, very hard to build my career. Started out as a freelance journalist. I got the opportunity to write sports for USA Today. And at the same time, I was producing for ABC Radio Sports Network, literally covering every team in New York. One night it was the Mets. The next night it was the Yankees, Knicks, Nets, Jets, Giants. So that gave me a great, pretty much entree into the sports world in the New York metropolitan area, where I was interviewing players and meeting sponsorship people. And so when I put together my own show, interview show, I had a lot of contacts, not only the athletes who I could book on the show, but the PR people, you know, sponsorship people. I actually went out and brought in my own sponsors for that show, which I think is my greatest legacy, the Sports Interview Archives. I have over 500 half-hour interview shows with the biggest legends in sports, many of whom aren't with us anymore. I was in my 20s, as I said, and 30s, interviewing these megastars who were much older, and they were so interested in telling their stories. So that's a small part of my career. I'm also an author, just came out with a book called Life on the Green, Lessons and Wisdom from Legends of Golf. It's my second book. My first book, A Passion for Golf, Celebrity Musings About the Game. So I've been at it for a while, Richard.
It seems that way. Now, was when you were growing